France is in the global spotlight. They're hosting the Olympic Games with perhaps the most controversial opening ceremony in history. Their trains have been sabotaged, the Israeli Olympic team needs round-the-clock protection. Meanwhile, they've just had a roller coaster of a parliamentary election, and they still haven't figured out who is going to be their prime minister. So let's take a look today at what the glare of the Olympic lights reveal about France in trumpet world. Hello and welcome to Trumpet World, a brand new video show from thetrumpet.com. It's a twice weekly show where we'll bring you the most important news from around the world. Throughout this show, I'll be joined by guests from our trumpet staff and from elsewhere as we give you a global perspective on the most important news, all guided from a biblical perspective. Now, the Olympic Games are often an opportunity to take a good, hard look at the host country. But this year, it's a bit different. Normally, the hosts put their best foot forward. 12 years ago, when Britain hosted, we had a whole issue exhorting you to look beyond the Olympic lights. Things look pretty glitzy and glamorous on the surface there, but behind the scenes, there were very important signs that society was falling apart. The story in France is a little bit different. You don't really even need to look beyond or behind the Olympic lights. Right from the Olympic flag being raised upside down, a lot of the dysfunction and division in France is right there on display. So I'm joined this afternoon by one of our European correspondents, Joshua Michels. Joshua and I have both been writing on France for several years. So let's start by using that Olympic spotlight to take a look at modern France. What are your overall thoughts on what we've seen so far?
Looking at France and Paris, but also at the host, Emmanuel Macron, the French president, for he is really a man that our editor-in-chief, Mr. Fleury, has been drawing quite a bit of attention to because of his audacious comments against America in particular. He wants to build up his own military, he wants a European power, and many will remember just after he got elected in 2017, he not just gave a speech about how he wants to transform France, he gave a speech on he wants to transform Europe and build it as a superpower. Now he comes to that Olympics, those Olympic Games hosted in France, and it's a prime opportunity for him to showcase the grandeur of France and Europe. And he really wants to show the tradition of Europe, but also the modernity of Europe.
At the same time, I mean, there are these quite high profile problems. I mean, a lot of them, I think, do highlight France's social dysfunction. You know, this is something that we've got an article in the upcoming Trumpet print magazine about, just the social divisions that we saw in the election. You kind of see that on display. I mean, it started with Friday was the big day, the opening ceremony. All of these different cultural objects were going to be on big, vibrant display. And that's when we kind of woke up to news with the trains are being sabotaged. Now it looks like that this was far left groups. I think they're not being super definitive about this, but there's social division on display there. The country spent €1 billion trying to clean up the river for them to swim in, only to, I think it was delayed on Monday. It was delayed again. They keep on having to delay the triathlon because the water is too dirty. There was a big thing. I don't know how much of it ended up coming out in practice, but certainly on social media, there was this big kind of deal where Mr. Macron said he was going to swim in that river. And so a lot of French people came out and promised to foul it in various creative ways. But all of these different things put in place different elements of social tension.
Yeah, that's right. And it used to be that sports unite people because you can all rally behind someone who runs that fast or jumps that high or does those amazing things, because it's not political in a way, but we have seen a transformation, not just in France and Europe, but around the world.
I think that's a really interesting point, both as a French phenomenon and an international phenomenon. I think Mr. Macron has kind of wrapped himself so publicly in this idea of France's glory as part of his political appeal. And so anything that diminishes that in France is almost an attack on him. But then internationally, I think I hadn't really thought about that much. But yeah, like the way that Russia has been excluded from what's going on there, over the Ukraine war, and I guess also doping for their athletes. But still, like, we can't really, it's becoming increasingly hard to keep politics out of these things. And then Israel, where I think the treatment of the reception that some of the Israeli athletes have received and were threatened to be received was absolutely shocking. I think it's not been quite as bad as people feared. I think they had a football match against Mali recently where the footage showed a minority of pro-Palestinian protesters that made it into the studio that were getting up there. And it sounded like they were on the video that they're chanting Heil Hitler, which is just shocking. But then what I thought was even more shocking was the statements coming from French MPs, where, again, from this Front Unbowed party, this party that did pretty much the best in this election, one of their MPs said, no, the Israeli delegation is not welcome in Paris. Israeli athletes are not welcome at all at the Olympic Games in Paris. Then another person from the same party, the Israeli flag stained with the blood of the innocent people of Gaza should not fly in Paris this summer. I mean, you're right. Everything is political and the world is more divided than ever. And so, yeah, this what was once more of a celebration of unity is becoming something where we can't keep our divisions and our politics out of it because those divisions are becoming so deep. I think moving on to that opening ceremony, I think this is something else that shows very deep divisions within France. I think the key part of that ceremony that has stirred the most controversy is this scene where the organizers appeared to be recreating the Last Supper. There's been some debate afterwards, and I don't know. I don't really want to get to the bottom of all this he said, she said about whether it was indeed the Last Supper, whether it was a different painting that was also inspired by Da Vinci's Last Supper painting, but depicts Greek gods. But you had this situation where you had, I guess, a plus-sized woman depicting Jesus Christ. You had transsexuals depicting the disciples, or at least that's how some are interpreting it.
Yes, the name of tolerance is bringing a lot of division to France right now. And from the leadership of France, they want to put that open and saying, this is our standard. All of us should be rallying behind it. And if you put it on the Olympics, the message is the whole world is supposed to be uniting behind this message.
Right. I mean, those images are pretty offensive, no matter how they try and dress them up. The Catholic Bishop Conference of France, they said that the Olympics made Christianity the subject of derision and mockery, which we deeply deplore. This morning, all our thoughts are with all Christians of all continents who are offended by the outrageousness and provocation of a few scenes. I mean, I'm not surprised that people are outraged by those scenes. I was surprised to see kind of Mr. Macron, who is pretty politically savvy, whatever you think of him, seemingly to endorse those. I mean, I haven't seen any criticism. He seemed to be like, yeah, I thought the Olympic opening ceremony was fantastic. And I think that ties very directly into French politics. I mean, if we come back to this election that we had just a few weeks before, the key party to that election was National Rally. This party that has had this history where they were under Jean-Marie Le Pen back in the 90s, there were the National Front, and they were kind of anathema. No one would do business with them. No one would form coalitions with them. And they were regarded as anti-Semitic. Jean-Marie Le Pen made some pretty outrageous comments on that. Since then, his daughter's taken over the party, and she's moved it in a very different direction. She's renamed it. Her father's kicked out the party. But still, there's a lot of people in French society looking at that and saying, well, is this marketing? Is this cosmetics? Or has this party fundamentally changed? They don't look and talk the way that they used to, but have they changed in their heart? You know, have they changed inside? This is the debate that's been going on for years within France. You had the European parliamentary elections where this party came in first place. Emmanuel Macron immediately called those snap elections for the French parliament, and they won the first round. The left-wing party, the right-wing party kind of came together, or Mr. Macron's party came together. They successfully managed to exclude them from power in the second round, despite the fact that National Rally got the largest percentage of the vote. But along all of this has been, well, what is the attitude of France's Catholics to National Rally? And National Rally and Mrs. Le Pen now, is she's put a lot of emphasis on trying to be the party for France's Catholics, and that will stand up for Catholicism within France. Now, a lot of Catholics have looked on that with suspicion because of the historical baggage. But you have the display that you had in the Olympics, and you have that opening ceremony that is seemingly endorsed and controlled by Mr. Macron. You could see that be a major turning point, where a lot of Catholics in France may well decide National Rally is the lesser of two evils. And you know, I think you could see this being a major... We have seen, and even under Mr. Macron, an increasing role for the Catholic Church in French politics, which is quite remarkable because France has some of the strictest walls in the world between church and state, religion and politics. That's been changing already, but you could see this being quite a major turning point in the role that the Catholic Church plays within the French state.
Yeah, it's very interesting to observe, especially if you consider how society is cementing their attitudes toward certain things, whether it's against immigration or if it's against LGBTQ sentiments or if it's pro-climate change. They are stronger and stronger and the people are supporting them and they're becoming radicalized. Centrist is almost not appearing anymore in the political spectrum because you have to polarize to gain voters these days. But now, as you said, there's a revival of more of a traditional Catholic movement. At the same time, there are movements where they say, well, the Catholic Church is the one that has to change. And Pope Francis is pushing that forward and others are pushing that forward. What I find interesting, and that sort of just came to me, some have compared what we saw in Paris with a new Babylon. And if you really think about it, that might be describing it pretty well, because Babylon has been the cradle of civilization. A lot of the cultural things that we see originated there, and a lot of the things that are modern come back from Babylon, but also the religions. Many of them trace themselves right back to Babylon. So Babylon seems to be the uniting factor.
I think this idea of polarization is a really interesting theme that I didn't necessarily expect to emerge from this discussion, both within the world and within France, people being pushed to those extremes. But this is something that we're really watching for, this trend in France and all of Europe, where for years Herbert W. Armstrong and then Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury have been forecasting that you're going to see a Christianity that returns to its Catholic roots. And there are really solid Bible prophecies that we'll get into in a few minutes. I want to have a segment where we kind of break that down very simply. But that's a very specific forecast. And what we have been seeing in recent years is this push almost to the opposite extreme within Europe. I mean, this is what we saw at the opening ceremony is extreme. And it's at an event that's supposed to be kind of mainstream and family-friendly that the entire country can get behind. But you have one faction that has very extreme views that they want to then really enforce on everybody and rub everybody's nose in it. That was what was on display on that. And I think we're seeing the backlash building. And it's going to lead exactly in this prophesied direction, where the pendulum is going to swing back the other way. And I think if you look close at the moment, it really does feel it's the woke movement that's in the ascendancy, that they control all the levers of power. But I think you look in certain places and you can see the backlash building. And you know, I think this is really at the heart of everything that we're talking about with France. I want to bring in your experiences with Germany as well in just a second, where the we're building towards a crisis that is unsustainable And the result of that crisis will be a swing back in the opposite direction. You know, a crisis in division within countries, in crime, with potential for terrorism that we kind of touched on. There have been reports of threats against the Israeli team. Israel's authorities have warned that Iran is going to try and target the Olympic Games. You know, all of this is going to lead to a shift to a very different kind of Europe. And it's going to be a Europe that's much more authoritarian, much more strongman leadership. And I think we're seeing movement in that direction, even with Emmanuel Macron. But then also a Europe that's much more religious. So what we're seeing, I think, in France is the pendulum starting to reach its other end before it swings back and we start to get that reaction to it. But this wasn't the only big sporting event of the summer, as I've just alluded to. There was the Euros in Germany. You were in Germany and on the scene for some of those Euros, not to go watch the games, I should add, but for some different reasons. You wrote up an article with some of your impressions and Germany's response. I think there's a certain shame within certain sectors of France based on what has been put on display with the Olympic opening ceremony. I mean, you wrote the same thing basically about the Euros in Germany.
Yes, I did watch some of the games, but not in any stadium.
But not that that would be wrong.
Yes.
But I just don't want to give our listeners the impression that that Joshua here is just traveling around Europe all the time covering sporting events.
And getting paid for it. I was in Germany for different reasons, but also on different trips. And on one trip, I was more in the south of Germany and I was more in villages. And they were pristine. Children were still playing on the streets and it was really a beautiful scene. And there are so many wonderful aspects in Germany that are still very orderly and very structured. But then you also go into some of the cities and you see a cultural decline and you see pollution and you see crimes. And one of those cities I have been reading about quite a bit, but I wasn't quite realizing that I was booked a hotel right at the center of one of those crime spots. Earlier I was on the other side of the main train station in Frankfurt a few weeks before that, and then I came to a hotel on the other side. And I couldn't believe my eyes. The whole street was filled with strangers and I felt unsafe. I was there with my wife and our little child that's below 1 year old and we did not feel safe. Later I researched the news and I found that I believe that that hotel owner was interviewed by some of the news media about what's happening on the street. But essentially it's a lot of drug dealers on there, lots of criminality. The police, we did not see much of them. But it's the main train station in Frankfurt and they were hosting some of those games for the Euro 2024, which means a lot of international travelers landed right there. They came out and they were welcomed by a scene of criminality. And I read lots of British people were flabbergasted. They were astonished by what they were seeing from what used to be a Germany of where you said the cities are law and order. You see beautiful cities, they are clean cities, one used to say. Well, that wasn't what they were welcome to, specifically in Frankfurt, but you go to other cities where you see very similar problems. And honestly, it's just sad. And then you realize that when you contrast that what with Germany has been used to and would like to see, like anyone would like to see a city that's clean and you feel safe, you can understand that they are desiring change, they're desiring different leadership, they're desiring more security on the street, and they're more open to that too.
And I saw, I think it was in your article, things from Bild, Germany's biggest tabloid newspaper, talking about, I mean, it was how big of a source of shame this was to Germany, which really stood out to me because of the Germany hosting the Olympic Games was such a big source of, or not the Olympic Games, it was the World Cup. It was such a big source of pride at the time.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
And they were genuinely very ashamed of people coming in and seeing this. So I think these sporting events over the summer have put a lot of the problems of Europe on display. I think Germany, you see how migration is changing the cities, rising crime. I think we've seen similar things within France. I mean, certainly those you can kind of drill down into whether France's anti-Semitism problem is homegrown or imported, and I think there's a bit of both. But a good chunk of that is parties supported by migrants, and this kind of radical Islam problem that's homegrown within France, this division, moral decline. I think all of that is really on display with these games. But to get a bit of another perspective on this as we kind of look at the future of these countries, I'd like to bring Abraham Blondeau into the discussion from our Canadian office. Well, first of all, good afternoon, Abraham.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Now these Olympic Games, they can give us a good snapshot about a country and a kind of a bit of an overview of that country, but they can do the same about a historical time period too. And that's what you're working on, where, as I alluded to earlier, we're watching it for the rise of a prophesied Holy Roman Empire out of the European Union. Again, something that I'll get into in a bit more detail soon. And the Olympics in the past were an opportunity for a previous resurrection of that empire to put itself on display to the world, and told us a lot about that time period. So this Olympics displays what really France and all Europe is missing, and kind of contrasting these two Olympics tells us a lot about the state of Europe. That's what your article is going to focus on, right?
Yes, that's exactly. And I think the discussion has been very interesting, and a lot of these themes that you've and Josue have been exploring, it really highlights that there's a rhyming to the history, that the modern events we're seeing play out in France with these Olympics, those same sort of feelings of fatigue with the ruling class, polarization, frustration, all of those themes were present back with this previous resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And what we're talking about is the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. And so if you're able to look at any images of these Olympics, for us in this modern era, having the benefit of hindsight, they look almost dystopian. They look almost too hard to believe, where at the opening ceremonies, you have the red swastika banners hanging right next to the Olympic banners. You have, during the Olympic march, when all the nations march in, they salute Adolf Hitler. And it's something that seems unnatural to us, but at that time, at the 1936 Olympics, all these nations, they were... The Olympics were a great chance for Hitler to showcase the Third Reich, or as him and his chief minister there of propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, they really wanted to use the Olympics to display the rebirth of Germany. So after World War I, that Germany felt pretty humiliated. And this was a huge moment when the Hitler regime was legitimate. Was made legitimate in the eyes of the world. And so all these nations came to Berlin, and it was going to show the rebirth of Germany after decades of weakness and a stigma from losing World War I. They were going to see a new Germany, a strong, confident, reborn Germany that could dazzle the world. And that's exactly what Hitler sought to do at the 1936 Olympics.
And I think that's an interesting point of contrast, even, or another role that Olympic Games can kind of play, is that both as a reflection and how they play into a nation's self-image. Because I think it is really interesting to contrast Germany's role and image of itself in 1930 compared to France, where, and again, I think this is an area where there are interesting parallels for today, where on paper, France was the stronger country. I think you look at almost every statistic in the 1930s, certainly when it comes to things like military strength, France was regarded as the senior power. But at the same time, there was an undeniable self-confidence within Germany under Adolf Hitler that wasn't there in France. And this was a time of 1930s France of deep, deep division. I mean, France at this time still has an empire. The sun never sets on the French Empire. At this point in time, it has 80 million inhabitants covering 4 million square miles of territory in that empire. 1936 is the same year that that Léon Blum becomes France's first socialist leader, and you have similar levels of division. You have the right within France hates Blum so much that you kind of get the slogan "Better Hitler than Blum." And really, there were things I think that were repugnant about both extremes within France at the time, the socialists and their adversaries. And so what this meant is when you had this self-confident Germany stomping all over Europe, France was paralyzed by its own internal divisions. It was consumed by political violence. There was once again a strong strain of anti-Semitism. Blum was also the first Jewish prime minister, and some of the opposition, or the first Jewish leader of France, there was opposition to him because of that. So there's some interesting parallels there, where once again Germany is dominating Europe, not militarily, but through their economy. They really are the dominant power in Europe. On paper, there's a lot in France's favor. Maybe a lot of the economic figures, Germany does stand kind of head and shoulders even above France. But for the longest time, France, until fairly recently, spent more on their military. France seems like it would be in a very good position to build a coalition of other countries like Spain and Italy, and potentially even to be able to impose its will on Germany. But they're not fundamentally opposing Germany because they're so divided. So I think there's 1936 has some interesting parallels there. But in your article, I think you were planning on moving on and kind of talking about how these Olympics really showcase what Europe needs today.
Yes, exactly. And I just add a point there. It's interesting because 100 years ago, Paris held the Olympics in 1924, and it was supposed to be this huge display of French culture. And it was I think they were very successful Olympics, but Germany did everything bigger and better in 1936. And no one really remembers the Olympics in 1924 in Paris. The Berlin Olympics, they really modernized the Olympics. A lot of the ceremonies and the mass media that are present in the Olympics today, Germany was the first one to do. The torch ceremony that was invented by Hitler. The 36 Olympics were the first ever broadcasted on television and radio at the same time. So Hitler really used this to broadcast to the world. And like you said, this is really preparing for the future. I just want to start off with this great quote from one of our booklets. So this is from our booklet, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. It's written by Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. And he says this, quote, "The sixth head," so that's talking about Hitler's the Third Reich, "ascended out of the underground. That means most of the world was ignorant of his existence." Then he says, "The beast," that's talking about the beast power of Revelation 13. We'll probably cover that more in a moment. He said, "The beast preys mightily on the world's ignorance. Deceit is its greatest weapon. The Bible says this is how it crushes its lovers," end quote. I thought that was a great summarization of Hitler's regime because it used deceit, propaganda, and the world was naive. They were ignorant about Hitler's what his intentions were for the most part, but also the heritage of the Holy Roman Empire that Hitler embodied. And we're seeing that play out again, where in Europe at the time, Germany in 1936, Hitler represented this newfound confidence, this going back to this heritage that always united Europe together. And the pendulum swing today is going in that same direction, where people are dissatisfied with this woke, this hedonistic culture that was on full display at the Paris opening ceremony. Then you have all the disruptions and the violence from immigrants in Paris the week before. And you just have, it's just really showing how disorganized and that our leaders like Macron, they can't even run events in their own country well. It just creates this huge feeling of embarrassment and dissatisfaction. And so we're seeing this pendulum swing. Okay, well, if this hedonism, this modern socialist culture can't unite Europe, well, what will? And it's this culture of the Holy Roman Empire, this church-state relationship. And you've seen this, like you said, with the Catholic Church becoming more vocal and more involved in events. And this is the warning that Mr. Flory continues in the Germany and the Holy Roman Empire book. I'll just give you one more paragraph. He says, quote, "We can understand the rising seventh head." So that's the Holy Roman Empire that's coming next that we're looking for. Much better and more easily if we understand the sixth. The sixth head gives us a dramatic preview of what is to happen in the near future one final time. All we have to do is grasp what the sixth head did, then multiply it by about 20 or 30. The Bible reveals that the sixth head has a very close tie to the seventh. End quote. And I think that's a fascinating quote because that really connects to what we're talking about here, is that these big displays of nationalism, these big spectacles that the world sees, like Olympic opening ceremonies, these can have a huge impact on swinging the culture in your direction and trying to unite people around your vision of what Europe is supposed to be. And so we see in 1936, Hitler, he did it pretty splendidly well.
And I think that's a really interesting point about this. There's a ready-made alternative. Because I think a lot of people watching the Paris opening ceremony probably left feeling pretty empty. I mean, I didn't watch it from start to finish. I've seen clips about the only really impressive thing I saw was when they kind of had those fireworks going off the bridge, and that looked pretty cool. But for a country that has so much in the way of culture and history, and a long history of artistic talent, and there just wasn't much of it there. There were one or two of these outrageous moments that we're all talking about, but a lot of the positive of France, I don't really think was displayed there. And you contrast that even to previous opening ceremonies, and you know, there are things, say on the London opening ceremony, there are things I didn't like, but I think there were moments of inspiration. Moments that were like, oh, okay, that's pretty cool. That's pretty inspiring. And even with say China or Russia. But the fact, so that leaves people empty. But your point that there's a ready-made alternative for Europe where they have all of this rich, deep culture that does have a whole lot of positives. You've got the music of Beethoven and Mozart and all of this artistic talent. And again, a lot of that is laudable and kind of the best of the human spirit, something I want to talk about a little bit even later on the show with another of our writers. But mixed in with that is the heritage of the Holy Roman Empire, really closely entwined with a lot of these different elements. And so you can definitely see how reaching for that heritage of the Holy Roman Empire, and Joshua, this is something you've written about quite a bit in the past. Not just the music, but the kind of the crown jewels of the Holy Roman Empire, the heritage of the Holy Roman Empire. There's a ready-made alternative to what we saw at the Olympic opening ceremony, and we're expecting Europe to reach for that very quickly.
In the rebuilding of Notre Dame, we saw some of that unifying factor in France, where they all rallied behind that Catholic heritage. But there's another aspect of the Holy Roman Empire where the left and the right now really can rally behind. And the Holy Roman Empire was inherently opposed to like British dominion. They were opposed to the rising American power early on, obviously. They could not prevent some of those things, but that's where they're really opposed. That's what Hitler really opposed as well. So if you're looking at it from that perspective, the Holy Roman Empire does have something where people can rally behind, where they're saying Europe needs to rise. We know the Catholic Church will be rallying, but it will be that unifying empire to oppose or to supersede, be greater than those other empires. So that's probably that vision that will bring them together. And that's what we see in left-wing extremism who oppose American capitalism, or right-wing extremists who oppose other aspects of America, where you see that unifying factor that was also present in the Holy Roman Empire.
I think that's a great point, that this comes with a different cultural vision, but that cultural vision comes with foreign policy consequences and really a kind of a complete vision of European empire that sees a very different role in the world for France and for Europe. And I think that's a great segue into what I want to discuss next, which is France's role in the Bible and what the Bible tells us about what is coming next to Europe. So Joshua, Abraham, thank you so much for joining us today. And we'll take a look at what the Bible has to say about this role of modern France and modern Europe. What does the Bible say about modern France? All around the world, millions of people believe that God is personally involved in their lives. They pray to God, they involve him in their major milestones in life. But if God is involved in the lives of individuals, if he hears prayers, well then, is he involved in the lives of nations? Does he play a role in world events? Well, absolutely he does. In Daniel 4 and verse 17, for example, God says that he rules in the kingdom of men, that he selects its leaders. In Matthew 24, Jesus Christ references Daniel's prophecies. He discusses Bible prophecy and what the Bible says about different world leaders, about the clash of armies and significant world events. So the Bible claims to tell you about modern nations and leaders. Do you believe it? Many don't talk about Bible prophecy because they don't understand it. They don't understand what scriptures talk about which nation. And our free book, The United States in Britain and Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong, it explains the master key that unlocks that understanding. In that book, Mr. Armstrong writes, "That key is knowledge of the astonishing identity of the American and British people, as well as the German in biblical prophecies. This very eye-opening, astounding identity is the strongest proof of the inspiration and authority of the Holy Bible. It is at the same time the strongest proof of the very active existence of the living God." This key unlocks the fate of nations. So here's a bit of vital Bible history to understand and get this master key. The biblical nation of Israel was made up of 12 tribes anciently, descending from the different sons of Jacob or Israel. Anciently, all 12 of these tribes were Israel. After King Solomon died, this kingdom of Israel split up. Judah became a separate nation with Benjamin sticking with Judah, and then the other 10 tribes, they were a separate people. And those northern 10 tribes, those 10 tribes excluding Benjamin and Judah, were carried into captivity by Assyria in the 8th century, and that's it, they vanished from history at that point. Now, the nation of Judah went into captivity eventually about 100 years later, and they eventually returned from captivity. And the Jews today, the nation of Israel in the Middle East, they are descended from this one nation of Judah. But what about those other 10 tribes? They're lost to the world. Historians generally believe that they were absorbed by surrounding nations and just kind of disappeared. They basically died out. What does your Bible say? Let's look at Genesis chapter 49. This is a chapter that has a detailed breakdown, a specific description of each tribe of Israel, and a description of what they would be like as a peoples much later on, beyond when they were just this individual, when they'd grown large into nations. But let's look at verse 1 of Genesis 49. And here it says, "And Jacob called unto his sons and said, Gather yourselves together, that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days." This is a prophecy of what each tribe would be like in the last days. So if 10 of these tribes died out, well, then your Bible is wrong. It is fundamentally flawed and unreliable. And this whole chapter in Genesis 49 is just nonsense because these tribes just disappeared and died out. Well, quite clearly, that is not the case. You can prove the Bible reliable and accurate, and then you have to know, well, these tribes have to be around here somewhere. And that's what Herbert W. Armstrong proves in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. After being taken into captivity by Assyria, the northern tribes of Israel migrated into Western Europe. Britain is descended from the tribe of Ephraim. The U.S. is descended from Manasseh. And Mr. Armstrong gives full proof of that in that book. And one of the points he makes in that book is that France is descended largely from Reuben. Genesis 49 and verse 3 gives us a few statements about Reuben. It says, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, the excellency of power. Reuben was the firstborn son of Jacob. That gives them a certain stature. And as it says there, there's an excellency of dignity, an excellency of power. I think that's part of what made the opening ceremony of the Olympics so disappointing. This is something, these kind of grand ceremonies, that France has typically done very well. There's a tradition of excellency and dignity that they bring to those kind of public spectacles. Verse 4 goes on to say, unstable as water. There's an instability there. And one of the things France put on display with their opening ceremony is their tendency for rebellion and revolution. Since 1789, France has had 14 constitutions and 5 different republics. They're well known for their love of protest. So France then is a nation of Israel. And not just any. Reuben is the eldest son of Jacob. 1 Chronicles 5 verses 1 to 2 describes how they were passed over for the birthright, for the lion's share of blessings. But they still have a certain status as that eldest tribe. Now, another thing Mr. Armstrong talks about in his book is Germany, and that they are biblical Assyria, the nation that anciently took Israel into captivity. This captivity was foretold many times before it finally happened in 718 to 721 BC. But all of these prophecies talking about Israel going into captivity into Assyria, they were dual. Many of these prophecies also describe a time of paradise, blessings, and abundance that would follow that captivity. And that didn't happen anciently, because those prophecies were about an end time captivity into an end time Assyria. The modern nations of Israel are once again going to be taken captive by Germany. Where does that leave France? Well, we've been looking at the first book of the Bible. The last book of the Bible gives us more details about this end time German-led power. Revelation chapter 17 and verse 3 describes a woman sitting on a beast. In the book of Daniel, a beast is used to describe great empires, and it's the same symbolism here in Revelation chapter 17. It's an empire, but here it's led and it's guided by a woman. That's a church, if we let the Bible interpret its own symbolism. So here we have an empire led by a massive, politically connected church. It's clearly referring to the Holy Roman Empire in Europe, led by the Catholic Church. Verse 10 of Revelation 17 says, and there are 7 kings. 5 are fallen, and 1 is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue after a short space. So the Holy Roman Empire rises and falls. There are a sequence of kings. You have a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire on the scene. It falls, it goes underground, only for another resurrection to come up some decades later. And in fact, that's exactly what we've seen in Europe, but there is in fact an amazing prophecy hidden in these verses. That when God revealed this prophecy, it would be during the 6th resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. 5 of them are in the past, 1 is still to come. And sure enough, God revealed this to Herbert W. Armstrong during the time of Hitler and Mussolini, during the 6th resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And notice a detail, though, about the 7th resurrection, this last resurrection, this last rise and fall. Verse 12, and the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings, 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. So for this final resurrection, it's not just Germany. There are 10 kings. Other nations come and join them and then give their strength and power to this overall empire. That's going to include France. Daniel chapter 2 describes exactly the same thing, just using different symbols. Instead, there's a giant statue portraying a succession of world-ruling empires. Its feet have 10 toes, pointing to the 10 nations that make up this final incarnation of the Roman Empire. And Daniel chapter 2 says that these feet are made of a mixture of iron and clay, so that they are partly strong and partly broken. In our booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, Mr. Flory writes, the clay represents some of the lost tribes of Israel, and God wants to shape and mold them. Example, Jeremiah 18 and verse 6. Yet Israel refuses. Here in this beast power, Israel is mixed right in with the Gentiles. They're able to come together in an emergency, but the unity won't last. It's a divided empire. And then he says, the fact that Israel is mixed in, like France, for example, makes it inherently weak. It will not last long. Now, France has a long history of cooperating with this Holy Roman Empire, even to the point of forming a major part of the Holy Roman Empire, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire under Napoleon, for example. So they are going to be one of these 10 nations, one of these 10 kings that gives his strength and power to this Holy Roman Empire. That means they will be turning their backs on Britain and the United States. They will be on the side of the captors. We see this already with Emmanuel Macron's foreign policy, the French president, where clearly he wants to break with America so Europe can be its own autonomous superpower, as he talks about. And already you can see partly why with these Olympics. You know, where did ultimately the culture that was on display with this Olympic opening ceremony that repelled so many people, where did that come from? Ultimately, it was from the United States and Britain. You know, the US and Britain have a culture that looks decadent, that is decadent and declining. And France throws in its lot with the Holy Roman Empire, this competing empire culture and system. Some of Reuben's ancient history foreshadows this betrayal. Genesis 37 describes the other sons of Jacob turning against Joseph, the father of Britain and America. Reuben, the father of France, sort of tries to stop them, but he lacks the courage to stand up the way that he should as the eldest child, as the one with the authority, as the one standing there in his father's place. And instead, he compromises. He convinces the brothers not to kill Jacob, but to leave him for dead inside a pit. And Reuben plans to come back later and rescue him, while he's gone, the other brothers decide to sell him into slavery. And Reuben never tells Jacob, Joseph's devastated father, what had happened, that his son is actually still alive and off in Egypt. He leaves him to think that his son is dead. And in our main June issue of the Trumpet magazine, Mr. Flory writes, this is history, and it is in the context of end time prophecy. This history is going to be repeated. France is once again going to not stand up for Joseph, for Britain and America. They'll stand aside, perhaps thinking, well, if we compromise with the beast power and play a role here, well, then maybe we can soften its attack and help them from the inside somewhat rather than making a futile resistance. But Mr. Flory in that article says there will come a point when Germany goes into full attack mode against America and Britain. Many prophecies reveal this. At that point, France will think, what have we gotten ourselves into? But by then it will be too late. Once they see the beast power that they have empowered and recognized, what utter devastation they have helped cause, the French people, like Reuben anciently, will be utterly shocked. But ultimately, they will have stood aside and enabled this to happen. Now, this is going to lead to a lot of devastation and correction for Britain, America, France, even for Germany. But there is fantastic good news that's also found in that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. All of this is part of God's plan to correct all of these nations and all the world. And ultimately, we parade our sins before the world, like we saw with the Olympic opening ceremony. Those sins are causing family breakdown, national breakdown, huge amounts of suffering. But God is raising up the Holy Roman Empire right now as part of his plan to turn the whole world to him. Britain, America, France, Germany, Russia, China, everyone. Now, you need to understand that hope and that plan. And our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, will help you do that. You can read that online at thetrumpet.com. You can also order your own free print copy. We'd love for you to have a copy that you can study alongside your Bible and take all of those statements that Mr. Armstrong says there and prove it for yourself. So if you click on the literature tab at the top right on the website, you can go and find that book. If you have any difficulty finding that, drop us an email at letters@thetrumpet.com. In fact, any questions or comments on the show today, we would love to hear from you. Please do get in touch. You can use that email, letters@thetrumpet.com. We'll take a short break now, and we'll be right back with a final segment that takes a bit of a different look at the Olympic Games. Welcome back to Trumpet World. We've been talking about France, its role in the world, and its role in Bible prophecy. Now I'm joined by Jeremiah Jacques for more of a positive look at the Olympic Games. Jeremiah, thank you for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, the Apostle Paul was greatly inspired by the Isthmian Games, an ancient relative of the Olympics. He describes a lot of parallels from these games for the modern Christian. And that is, I believe, the subject of an article that you're working on right now, Jeremiah.
Yes. So right now in Paris, on tracks and trampolines, in swimming pools and river stretches, on wrestling mats and in the velodrome, the world's best athletes are competing against each other. And they are, as you said, taking part in a tradition that spans back millennia. The Olympic Games started all the way back in the 8th century BC in Olympia, Greece. And ever since then, they have captured the attention of sports enthusiasts and most anyone else who has watched them. The modern games transcend typical sports markets, and they captivate worldwide attention as little else can. And that's partly because they give spectators a feeling of being connected with a global community. And it's partly because they offer kind of a riveting microcosm of national rivalries and competitions. But the main reason why so many watch the game so enthusiastically is just to see the sheer athleticism, the unmatched levels of inspirational athleticism that they display. Back in ancient Greece, Olympians strove to emulate the traits of Homeric warriors. Many of these early participants lived during times of peace, but they were inspired by stories they had heard of the strength of Ajax and the speed of Achilles, the vigor of Ulysses, and the arete, which means excellence and determination, of men like Diomedes. So the desire of the ancient Greeks to demonstrate these kinds of warrior ideals, even during peacetime, drove many of them to compete in the Olympics. And there, through dazzling feats, they pursued glory on the field of athletics instead of the field of battle. Now, in our modern era of technology, athletes are really striving to eclipse records against the stopwatch and against the measuring tape. And of course, they're still pursuing precise, exacting excellence. Their quest for excellence pits them not only against their contemporary competitors, but also against every athlete who has lived and set records before them. This ambitious pursuit cannot be undertaken without great quantities of arete. The pursuit of this kind of elite-level athleticism is very inspiring to see, and the Bible actually draws on this to teach Christians some profound lessons. Back in the 1st century AD, when the Apostle Paul was writing his epistles, the Olympic Games were enormously popular. And Paul's familiarity with various competitive sports really spawned some of his most effective analogies. Every 4 years, a set of games called the Isthmian Games that you mentioned a moment ago were held in that narrow isthmus in Corinth. And the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary points out that Paul's sports analogies would have been especially impacting for church members in Corinth, just because these Olympian games, these Isthmian games took place there. The commentary states, "The Isthmian games were to the Greeks rather a passion than a mere amusement, hence their suitableness as an image of Christian earnestness. These competitions were a subject of patriotic pride to the Corinthians, who lived in the immediate neighborhood," end quote. So the Apostle Paul was well aware of the games and of their enormous popularity, and he told church members in Corinth that the life of a Christian is similar to the quest for victory that they saw in the runners who competed in these games. In 1 Corinthians 9:24, he wrote, "Know you not that they which run in a race run all, but one receives the prize. So run that you may obtain. End quote. Paul also pointed out that the stakes for an aspiring Christian are far, far higher than those of an athlete. Verse 25 says, now they, these Olympic athletes, push themselves to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. So he is stressing that the Olympians, the only thing they really receive is some award that will eventually turn to dust, but that a Christian is pushing for life, real life that lasts forever. Paul went on to explain that he exerted himself to the utmost so that he would not fail to secure that incorruptible crown of eternal life. In verses 26 and 27, he wrote, I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beats the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means when I've preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. So these passages are just a few of the ones where the Apostle Paul pointed his Christian brothers to the finest athletes of their day. It was an analogy that he often employed because these athletes, like today's contenders in Paris, were brimming with passion, zeal, and a deep-rooted drive to demonstrate arete in their sport, real excellence and character, even though doing so required them to bring their bodies into subjection with the most arduous training regimens and self-discipline. The Bible makes plain that zeal is fundamental to the life of a Christian. You can see that in passages like Isaiah 59:17. And it makes plain that self-discipline is an absolute necessity for someone who's striving to live like Christ. Proverbs 25:28 shows that. The Bible also reveals in passages like Colossians 3:23 that Christians must struggle to invest their hearts deeply into all that they do. And it shows in places like Matthew 5:48 that they must strive to become perfect. And then Philippians 4:4 shows that a Christian must do all of this with joy. Now, it is true that Olympic competitions can often become, you know, that microcosm of rivalries between nations, and it can bring out the selfishness and aggression of the athletes. But this world-class athleticism can also occasion the noblest zeal and passion, and it can showcase the heights that the human spirit is capable of achieving. So if you join the hundreds of millions who are watching the Olympic Games in Paris, I hope you'll contemplate the self-discipline required for these athletes to have achieved such mastery over themselves, and reflect on the sheer effort that they exert in their quest for excellence and for a medal, and consider the spiritual parallels.
Thank you so much for that, Jeremiah. I think that is a great perspective to have when watching those games. There are just so many stories that kind of brim with lessons for the Christian life. I mean, just getting into this, looking at some of the stories with this kind of in mind today, I'm not usually a massive sports viewer, honestly. But this has made me think, well, maybe I need to look into this a bit more. I don't know whether you saw the account of Britain's Tom Pidcock in the mountain bike racing that he was the gold medalist in Japan last year. He was going into the mountain biking this year. It's I think 2.7 mile course, 8 laps. He's halfway through. He's in the fourth lap. He gets a puncture. And it basically seems like that's it. He's all over. He must be incredible, not just at racing, but at fixing punctures. He got it fixed, but he's still 40 seconds behind the leader, which, you know, in an Olympic-leveled competition, 40 seconds is miles behind. He's halfway through the race, 4 laps to go. He didn't think he was going to win, didn't necessarily think he'd catch up, but he just said, well, it's a fight, and you just got to go for it. And that's what he did. He was 40 seconds behind. He put his fight hard into it. Final lap, he was chasing the leader by just a few seconds. Still looked like he couldn't quite get past him. Took an unusual route around a tree, used that to hop in the lead, took the gold medal. I mean, it was just an absolutely incredible moment. But again, just like you've kind of directed, I think with what you've discussed, your perspective in mind, I mean, what a lesson for us. That there are times that it can just look like you're down and out. What's even the point of carrying on? The gold is gone. The prize is gone. It's impossible. But he just got back up, kept pedaling, didn't quit, and had this incredible comeback. So thank you so much for helping us view all of these different sporting events with that in mind, Jeremiah.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Well, that is about all we have time for on Trumpet World today. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. We will be back on Friday. And until then, keep watching your world.